after 10 years, Bobby from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I am Bob Earl. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. Alcoholic, addict, whichever is least offensive to you. You want this one up a little? Actually, I was talking to the taper. Are we okay? Back in the back? Huh? Can somebody get one of the hotel people to crank up their system a little? Whoever's in charge of that aspect of the conference? Any better? See, I'm from a family that does stuff like that, you know. There's a plate on fire, so they just pick it up from there and move it to there and go back to the drinking. And it's like, somehow this problem will resolve itself. For anyone out there like me who didn't get the oblique reference to Badger, it means they're both from Wisconsin, if you're interested. Ah, more! Chet wants your names after the... I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be back at a winter holiday. He hadn't told me that story. I didn't know that story. And I'm particularly delighted to be at a conference that is acknowledging the fact that this is a family disease. And that you include Al-Anon and make it an important part of the conference, and that you have a considerable amount of Al-Anon activities. I think it's good. I think it's commendable. I get very tired of listening to AA speakers derive humor at the expense of their Al-Anon spouses. Actually, I don't like anybody who derives humor at the expense of anybody else anymore. I used to think it was about the funniest humor there was and used to participate in it a lot, you know. But then I guess we've got a different conception now today in 1995 of what we care means than we did in 1962, we care meant sit down, shut up, listen, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you knew anything, you wouldn't be here, so don't speak. I hope it's changed a little. A little. Another thing we have going now, which just amazes me no end, is I've been to so many meetings lately, and they read this in the preamble to their meetings that we request that you limit your sharing to your alcoholism. Okay. I wonder if anyone is aware that I am the only living human being on the planet that can make the determination whether or not what I'm sharing about has anything to do with my alcoholism. I could be talking about my parakeets, you know, having some pneumonia. And you would say, well, but if you don't understand my emotional relationship with my parakeet, you may not know what I'm going to go through. I drink over emotional disturbance, one kind or another. And what will set me off won't set you off. And what will set you off won't set me off. So I'm never in a position to make that judgment as to whether or not what you're sharing has value or merit or doesn't have value or merit. The only other thing I'd like to see you add someday to this conference is an ACA meeting, now that we've come to understand that the person that gets hurt the most by this disease is the children. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. There's too much information in now to tell us that this is the case. I am an adult child. I was raised in what is rapidly becoming the average American family. One alcoholic parent. One parent that needs that kind of excitement. And for the children, in one way or another, usually it's a war zone. My mother, unable to take her anger out over my father's drinking and his inability to communicate with her and the deteriorating relationship between them, had a male child, and I became the target of all her anger. My mother's a child beater. She was a serious child beater. The woman who used her fist, she split open the corners of my eyes, she broke my nose. She'd be in prison if she tried to do to me in 1995 what she did to me between 1935 and 1940. Between 1935 and 1940, there was a real simple rule. You don't mess in your neighbor's business, particularly if it has anything to do with their children. They can do what they want with their children. One of the things I know now about growing up in a home where there's an alcoholic parent is there's a lot of tension. Basically, it's like growing up in a war zone. You never know what's coming next. You cannot depend upon what's coming next. I could do something one day, and it was funny and cute and adorable and darling, and everybody loved it, and I'd do it the next day, and I'd wind up being knocked down and just completely destroyed. So by the time I hit school, I was already in that place of wondering, of feeling different, feeling like I didn't belong, feeling insufficient, incomplete, like there was something awfully wrong with me, and my whole job was make sure that you didn't find out what it was that was wrong with me. This was like my biggest secret. I never can let you see this one tiny little spot inside of me that is my hidden secret. This is like a little bubbling pot of sewage, and I don't want you to find it out. We have a name for it today. It's called shame. I didn't do any better in school. It was so tense at home, I had picked up some bad habits to save my life. And in school, when they ask you a question, they expect you to answer it. Well, in my home, it wasn't healthy answering questions. It was you have to figure out what the answer should be. So that by the time I'm in second grade and I'm confronted with Mrs. Cooney, a very large, angry woman with big black corrective shoes, and I'm not making fun of people with corrective shoes. I have orthotics in my boots. But she'd walk up, she put a two, I'll remember this day probably till the day I die. The second grade was 51, 52 years ago. She put a two on the blackboard, another two, a plus sign, drew a line underneath and spun on me and said, "Bobby," oh God, you know why me. The problem was not that I didn't know the answer. I knew the answer. I knew two and two were four. I had things I needed to work out before I answered. The first thing I had to figure out was, why does she want to know? Right? I mean, children judge the outside world based on what's happening within the framework of their home. In the framework of my household, I was being asked questions by parents that had no business knowing the information and no need for the information, and I was getting slugged for the answer. Once I finally resolved to my satisfaction that it was part of Mrs. Cooney's job description to elicit from me some form of proof that I was in fact retaining the information she was dispensing, I moved on to the next part of my problem. Did she know the answer? At home, I'm being asked questions by parents who do not know the answer to the question they're asking me, and I'm being punched for giving the right answer. So I'm a little leery about all this. Sitting next to me in the second grade is Susie, who I can still also remember 52 years later. Susie also had an alcoholic father. But she reacted to the alcoholism in her home different than I reacted to the alcoholism in my home. Susie was going to be a straight-A student until she died. She probably has more credentials today than she can use. She probably has more credentials today than 10 people can use. She was going to shore up the self-esteem of her family by her report card. It's a tragic that children can do that in our society. But see, Susie could hold up her report card. Her family could hold up her report card and say, "See here? See here? This girl got straight A's. Straight A's. So, okay, so our Christmas lights are still on the house and it's July. It doesn't matter. This child got straight A's. And if this child gets straight A's, it means our family is okay." Well, what I realize now with the information I possess, when they had asked me about 2 plus 2, when Mrs. Cooney had asked me, and I'm sitting here trying to work all this stuff out, Susie is under incredible stress. A question has been asked, she knows the answer, and silence hangs in the air. Anyway, Susie couldn't contain herself, and before I got an opportunity to answer the question, she jumped up and went, "4! 52 years later, man, I can still see those fingers. up in the air. Four. All right, now I have two problems. One more note is going home with me because I have a very high IQ, but I'm very slow. So in those days, they had very little information. And if you had a high IQ and you were slow, your slowness was perceived to be intentional. Therefore, I was not a troubled child who needed help. I was a bad child. I was being difficult on purpose. And now, at recess, I had to figure out a way to take Susie's life. Because, you see, Susie had committed the one absolute cardinal sin. She had drawn public attention to the fact that I wasn't okay. The whole class knew. She was able to jump up before me and give the answer. And one more time, that was that God-awful, horrible, "I'm different, I'm not enough. If you ever find out, you'll leave me or make me go away." And I just didn't want to face it. The only thing that changed for me in school was always difficult, terribly hard, was by the time I was about 12 or 13 years old, I hit 6 feet. My relationship with my educators changed at that point. I didn't have to listen to it anymore. If it upset me, if I couldn't answer it, if I couldn't handle it, I could walk by the teacher's desk, drop all my books in the wastebasket, make a socially unacceptable gesture, and walk out the door. The vice principal had already made it clear to the teachers he did not want to see me again, ever. So he didn't know what they were going to do with me, but I was not to be sent back to his office because I'd already thrown a chair through the window in his office. By the time I'm 15 years of age, I've been thrown out of two high schools in the city of Los Angeles, and they send me to a high school in L.A. that used to be there called Reese. Reese was a high school for young men like me. I do not believe there was one educational credential among the entire teaching staff at Reese. Everyone there, as far as I know, was either a currently employed juvenile police officer or a retired juvenile police officer. They were there for one reason, to keep us little gorillas in our seats for the necessary 6 hours and then turn us loose. To give you an idea of what I was like at 15 years of age, I had not yet drank anything. I had not yet had any narcotics of any kind. I lasted one day in Reese High School. At the end of one day, they called my mother and said, "Forget it. We do not want him in the Los Angeles educational system. Get him a job." That's what I had become by the age of 15. I had more emotional problems than any six people I knew, and I hadn't even yet discovered anything to drink. 3 days later, I'm in Hermosa Beach with some friends of mine. Somebody offers me this funny little cigarette to smoke and a gallon jug of red wine to wash it down with. I took this funny little cigarette, drew deeply on it, and washed it down with a little red wine, and magic happened. And this, to me, is what alcoholism is all about. This, is to me, is what addiction is all about. It's what all of it is all about. I don't care what you used. I don't care where you used it. I don't care how much you used. I know one thing that every one of us in this room has in common is the first time we got the stuff, magic happened for all of those who were already emotionally troubled. I felt okay. I liked the beach suddenly. The sand wasn't this terrible irritant it had been. Women took on a whole new interest to me. A little red wine and a little marijuana, and I just lit up. Hi. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but I know it's going to be more fun than anything I've done until this point in my life. The next 3 years of drinking and using narcotics was like driving a fine car down the highway of life, man. It was good. It was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. They did what they were supposed to do. If I took uppers, I went up. If I took downers, I went down. If I smoked grass, I got paranoid. If I drank, I blacked out. Basically, I had control. I had control over my substance abuse. Everything was going really well, and then one morning that terrible, awful, horrible thing that most of you know about happened. I got up and I put in my system everything I've been putting in my system, and it didn't work. It didn't work the way it was supposed to work. And I spent the next 8 years, early on in AA, I had a problem. It nagged at me and nagged at me and nagged at me. And I would go to people in meetings and I'd take them aside and I'd say, okay, look, I got it. All right. I'm addicted. I'm an alcoholic. I got it. I understand that. But why did I go to such lengths to anesthetize myself? And I'd get this answer. And that's the only reason I got the answer is because the only one anybody had been. Look, kid, if you look like a duck, you walk like a duck, and you quack like a duck, you're a duck. It was like being in the second grade with Mrs. Cooney. You know, it's like, what the hell has this got to do with anything? But I didn't have enough esteem to speak up. I just did what most of us do with our sponsors. I know, okay. I got it. I understand. Because I spent 8 years of absolute misery. And this is the period in our addiction or alcoholism when people look at us and say, my God, if it did that to me, I'd quit. And they can't understand why we'll put ourselves in positions where we're being handcuffed to the bumpers of sheriff's department cars and drug around the block as an indicator of what they'll do to you if you do what we did to them. You know, I mean, it's like this incredible madness, institutions, mental hospitals, everything that went on during this next 8 years of my life. The incredibly god-awful parenting job I did with my two daughters for 3 years. I mean, just all that. Why would anybody do that? Why would anyone go through that? All I wanted was the moment back. All I wanted was to feel okay one more time. I just wanted to have some control. I just wanted to put something in my body and feel okay. And smile again for the first time in a long time. And that moment never came. I never got it again. I never captured it again. I wound up 26 years old living in doorways in Pasadena, California. August 28, 1962, I rolled into my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. An Eskimo took me. I beg your pardon? Eskimo? An Eskimo. Well, that's about, I'll have to tell you what an Eskimo is then, I guess. When I was about 2 years sober, I was having a terrible, terrible, terrible time with any connection with a higher power of any kind. And the reason for that was, I went up to somebody early on in my recovery, so I know what it was. I was talking to somebody about a problem, and a sergeant in AA stepped forward and and gave information they had not been asked for. And said, son, if I had a problem like that, I'd turn it over. Yeah, that's a good concept. I like that concept. That's an interesting concept. Turn it over. This had a nice ring to it. Give it to somebody. This had real appeal. So I said, to who? And he said, God. I said, who's God? He says, your father. He loves you. Bad image. Not one that made me want to let it go, not one that made me want to pray. My father was a man that I could, whatever I did, no matter how hard I tried, I never was enough. I couldn't get held, I couldn't get kissed, I couldn't get attention, I couldn't get strokes, I couldn't get nurturing. It was not in his nature or his ability to give it to me. He didn't have the tool. Doesn't change the pain, but he didn't have the tool. I could not see a working relationship with a higher power that was my father. So I just kind of ignored God for a couple years because I couldn't get an image. I couldn't get a hold of anything that would work. You know, except the old throne thing, and that one was very frightening that he had a book. I wasn't even leaving with the state of California, so I figured God and I were in serious, you know, differences. And I'm in this meeting one night, and the speaker tells this wonderful story about these two men sitting in a bar in Alaska. One of them's an atheist, and the other's a very religious man. They're both drinking. Partway through the conversation, the atheist looks at the religious man and says, "You know, I don't believe in your God." The atheist says, "Well, why not?" The atheist says, "Well, I gave him a chance to prove himself to me once, and he didn't do it." The religious man says, "In what manner did you give God a chance to prove himself?" The atheist says, "Listen, I was lost about 6 months ago, about 150 miles north of town here." He said, "There was a terrible blizzard." He said, "I knelt down in the snow, and I looked at the sky, and I screamed, 'God, if there is one, I'm lost. I'm going to die.'" And the religious guy looks at him, he says, "Why, you must believe. You're here." He says, "Nah, some damn Eskimo came along. Show me the way back to town." So, I was sitting in, now to answer your question, is the one Eskimo is. So I'm sitting in my doorway, I'm 26 years old, my brains are completely fried, I don't have any place to live, I weigh 135 pounds, I weigh 200 now, to give you an idea of what I look like, 65 pounds lighter. And so I'm completely destroyed, sitting in this doorway. I have the phone number of AA in my pocket, because I've gone before a judge. My last 502, or driving under the influence, I guess it is now, whatever the hell you call it now, I went before his judge. He gave me 5 weekends in Lincoln Heights Jail in Los Angeles, and I showed up drunk for the first two, so they arrested me for drunk. My last arrest is common drunk, place of arrest, main floor, city jail, Los Angeles. This is not exactly the cool guy cruising down Broadway in L.A. and he's 33 Ford Victoria smoking a little grass, you know, with the... Oh, well, it takes what it takes. So I had to go back and face this judge, and I'm watching this guy just kill people with sentences, and I'm just sitting there waiting to see him because I violated everything. I have failed to execute a sentence with my jacket. That's a felony. I'm going to prison. I mean, I know I'm in major trouble here. And a guy in front of me, and the judge is not in a good humor, and the guy in front of me gets up and the judge says, "Well, I see here you got a couple of kids and a wife, and so I'll let you serve the 10 days, then weekends, 5 weekends in Lincoln Heights Jail," which is what he originally gave me. And the guy says to the judge, "Your Honor, if it's all the same to you, I just shouldn't do the 10 days straight." And the judge looks at him and says, "Well, I was just trying to have some respect and consideration for your employer, your wife, and your child, but if you insist, you can do the 10 days straight, you can do 180 on top of it. Till maybe you learn to have a little respect for your wife and child." So I thought, this is not going to go well. This is just not going to go well. So he says to me, "You got anything to say?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to call AA and do something about my problem." I had absolutely no intention of calling AA. I had no intention of asking any human being, anyone on the planet for help for any reason, ever. And he lit up like a spotlight. He says, "Ah, good, good. You're like AA." He says, "You'll find a new way of life there." He said, "You'll make many new friends. This will be good for you." He said, "I know this to be true because my brother has been sober 9 years. And he let me walk. So, I had AA's phone number, I had a dime, and I must have gone. Shame is a very interesting thing. I took that dime and that phone number to a phone booth, I'd say 50 times, 100 times. I'm sick, I'm tired, I'm 26 years old, I'm physically almost dead from the substances, the alcohol and the drug. And I cannot drop that dime on a phone and call somebody, I don't know, in an office someplace I've never been and say, "Help me." I would rather die and let you know that I can't do it. Because you see, the minute you know I can't do it, then you know there's something wrong with me. And the minute you know there's something wrong with me, you're going to leave me or make me go away or call public attention to the fact that I'm not okay. So I'm sitting in this doorway ready to die and an Eskimo comes by. He wasn't wearing a wonderful outfit like Wally, but an Eskimo came by. This is a guy who owed me a lot of money. Ever since I'd known him and his wife and her six children, he'd been on welfare, man, and I'd given him lots of money off of robberies and things that I had been involved in. He probably owed me $5,000, and in 1962, that was represented a sizable amount of money. And he looks at me sitting down here in the corner in my doorway. He says, come on with me, man. You can come stay with me and my wife. I could go with him. He owed me. It's his duty, man. It's the code of the street. You take me with you. You owe me and I need something. Let's go. Him and his wife and six children were living in this beat-up, run-down, skid row, one-bedroom apartment. And I'm sitting there, and I say to him, one of these days, I got to call AA. He says, there's a girl down the hall goes to AA. I couldn't even pull up a mental picture of what I imagined a girl in 1962 going to AA looked like, but I needed to know. I walked down the hall, knocked on the door, and the girl who opened the door, it was perfect for me. Perfect. A gift from God. She was 6'2", 6'3". She weighed about 235 pounds, built like a pro football fullback. She had short black hair, tattoos down both arms and both legs, and she was standing there with a half full pint of booze. This was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we tiptoe around on eggshells worried about what we say to the newcomer. Where on God's earth do you think the newcomer is coming from? You know? Well, she was fine for me because she was my kind of people. You know, I looked her dead in the eye. I said, man, I need to do something about my drinking. I need to go to AA. And she looked me right in the eyes and she said, hey, it will work if you want it, and I am not ready to quit drinking. At different times in my life, different things have made sense to me. At that moment, that was perfectly logical. It made perfect sense to me. I'm a whacked out, completely destroyed, 135-pound, ripped human being. I took one look at her and thought, yeah, hell, if I was big and strong like you, I wouldn't quit either, you know? I mean, it was... And bless her heart, she felt responsibility for the sobriety she had. She stuck me in a car and took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's over 32 years ago. I've been clean and sober ever since, that meeting. Didn't want to necessarily stay. Didn't like the people. Wasn't particularly fond of meetings, and I got sober in Pasadena, California. Everybody was old already. They were old when they started to drink. And we had problems communicating. Some of these people had a sense of social responsibility. You know, they got drunk at the country club and passed out on the 18th green, embarrassed themselves, and got sober. When it came to emotional issues, we had trouble communicating with each other. I'm busy taking the chairs apart in the meeting, piece by piece, with little pieces of wood, just ripping them off, you know, because I need something to do with my hands so I don't kill a speaker or somebody else at the meeting. And they're okay. And I begin the adventure, the great adventure of sobriety. And one of my sponsors said a very powerful thing to me. He says, listen, you need never drink or use drugs again as long as you live from this day forward if you don't want to. No, none of one of his day, one day at a time crap, which I believe in thoroughly, but at that moment I needed to hear that. I was 26 years old. I had a lot of years left in front of me. I needed to know this thing was going to work for a long, long time. I've heard, I can't even tell you how many countless speakers I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about, oh God, this guy talked with 6 weeks, and I was so impressed. He had 6 weeks of sobriety, and I couldn't just imagine how you got 6 weeks of sobriety. I didn't even listen to people with 6 weeks of sobriety. I didn't care about people with 5 years of sobriety. If they said there's a guy speaking 100 miles away at 20 years, I was there. I was there. I wanted to hear, what do you do for 20 years sober? Because that was a very real concern of mine. Being 26, that was only 46 years of age. I needed to know, and I was already concerned about what was I going to do with my time, you know. Now that I wasn't drinking anymore or trying to put drug deals together, what am I going to do with my time? And I began to go to meetings, and I did almost everything you tell people not to do. Some of it I was a victim, but it's okay. Everybody said, don't get emotionally involved for the first year. This is an this is equally as intelligent as the Just Say No campaign. Oh, we're going. Men have been known to tiptoe through minefields in order to have sexual relations with a woman, and you're saying, don't get emotionally involved. When I was 3 weeks sober, I was asked to give a 10-minute talk. In the audience was a woman who had 3 months of sobriety, an old-timer. This is the truth. So help me God. After my talk, she came up to me and she informed me that her sponsor had told her if she heard anything she liked at a meeting, she should take it home. Although she was about 6 years older than me, she'd been a Pasadena Rose Princess and she was absolutely stunning. I went. About a week after we got together, she had a complete mental breakdown and landed in a private psychiatric hospital. I did not yet have a sponsor. I didn't know what to do. So I went and visited her every day. I also didn't have a job. I went to visit her every day in the psychiatric hospital and took her get well cards, which I understand now is very sick, but it made sense at the time. And we'd sit by the swimming pool in this swanky psychiatric hospital, read the big book, and talk, plan the rest of our lives together with God, AA, and the 12 steps. We lasted about a year and a half before we finally gave it up. An incredible year and a half. One of these couples that probably broke up and went back together 14 times, you know. And then about 10 or 12 years passed, and we didn't see each other. About 12 years later, I spotted her at a meeting, and she spotted me, and it was like a Clairol commercial, you know? We just sort of bounded across this Alano Club, you know, towards each other. And we threw our arms around each other, and at the same time, we said the following. Thank you for being part of saving my life. As bad as it got for us, as tough as it got for us, as crazy as it got for us, we saved each other's lives. She trusted everybody. I trusted nobody. And we were a great balancing act. We saved each other's life. We didn't know how to do a relationship. We didn't know how to do anything, but we hung on to each other. We made, I mean, when we started to fall apart, the relationship started to fall apart, Joyce had the ability to stop living better than any human being I have ever known in my life. When she stopped dead. She could sit in a chair in the living room with no clothes on for 3 days and not move. If you have not noticed, my energy level is a little higher than that. And we didn't have any of the information in those days about depression that we have now. You know, we didn't know anything about it. For Christ's sakes, we're still giving diabetic alcoholics Carol syrup and orange juice, putting them into comas in the clubhouse, you know. My sponsor walked in one day to see me, walked past Joyce in the living room and said, what are you today, Joyce, cabbage or carrot? You know, it's like... Much of the humor in those days was at the expense of other people. Well, we'd separate. It would finally become impossible, and we'd separate. You can't live like this. And besides, I'd start gaining a little weight, and I wouldn't shave, and I started to look really bad, and she'd just sit in the chair, you know, and just sort of rut. Maybe 6 weeks would go by, we wouldn't see each other. Because I was brought up by sponsors that said, if you break up a relationship, it's the male's responsibility to go across town to meetings and let the woman be safe in her meeting. I don't either agree with that, but that's what the hell went on then. It worked for me. But after about 6 weeks, I have to get back to one of the old groups. I go back in there, and she be. Well, both of us now are sort of on the hunt again. And I've lost the 10 extra pounds I put on and slimmed down and dressing good and shaving and going to meetings and looking sharp. And she's back being this absolutely gorgeous, stunning rose princess she once was. And we would take, because we had no tools of any kind to speak of, we would take one look at each other and say, my God, why did we separate? We did this a half a dozen times. And that was with Elsa as a buddy of ours. No one could get through to us. Why not? We needed each other desperately to save our lives. Okay, so sobriety begins. I have sponsors who believe in activity. Get busy. First was meant putting up chairs. And when they figure you can be trusted, making coffee. Then greeting people at the door when your attitude improves enough that they feel you can greet people at the door safely. You know? Well, I'd say, what are you doing here, man? You know? And it was in this phase that they began to get it that I was different. And I began to understand I had problems. Because other people doing this work loved it. Or at least they said they did. People were getting to the podiums at meetings and they were saying, I am so grateful to this group for the opportunity to make coffee. I get here 3 hours early every night and get to spend time with the pots and the coffee in this temple to God. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah. And I'm making coffee at the Tuesday night meeting, and I tell you, man, I'm thinking about Raid, putting Raid in it. You know, it's like, nobody says thank you, nobody cares, nobody's kind, nobody, you know, it's like, give me a break with this coffee crap, you know? Or then you get the cleanup part after the meeting, which is the mop, and they spill their coffee, and they don't say anything, and they leave cigarette butts in the car. I mean, it's like you just want to drop them on the way out the door with the mop. But nobody is saying this. Everybody else is grateful to mop the floor. And then you get a year. And your sponsors light up like they've had a baby, you know. I mean, I like pull out the candle on my first cake. It's like, God. I made it. A year. If I can do a year, I can do 20. And they just scooped me up and they said, now you can carry panels in the institutions. And I looked at my two sponsors like they were crazy. I said, what for? I don't care. They said, and I was always, this kind of logic was always used with me. When it came to setting up the meetings, my sponsors would say, get there early, set up the chairs, or break your back. I can work with that. You know? That's a logical approach that I can deal with. It's not, it's because it was familiar. It was like being home with mom and dad. You do this or we kill you. You know? It's like, okay, I can do this. I thought I couldn't, but I can. And so when it came to institutional work, they just said to me quite simply, hey, listen, man, either you start going back in where they wear blue and brown, or you're going to wind up living where they wear blue and brown. I got it. Works for me. I can do that. And then they gave me the worst panels on the face of the earth, because these are the ones no one else will take unless they just got a year and one day of recovery and don't know any better.
Yes.
Now, the first panel I get is County Hospital, Los Angeles County Hospital. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a little touchy about germs. Actually, it's more than a little touchy. I'm a compulsive, obsessive personality. I get completely nuts about germs. So now I'm going to Los Angeles County Hospital. And you go there, you meet in a room, and they give each one of you a book, which is for a floor. And in the book, all patients' names on the floor and their room number and all that. And in it, marked with a big red star, are those that are there for directly or indirectly because of alcohol. And the doctors mark the book. So if a guy broke his leg, but he was drunk, there'll be a star. Because they want us to know that he didn't just actually, you know, slip, that he had some help. So, I really don't like being in a hospital. I haven't had any luck in hospitals. I've been on the sixth floor county psycho 3 times. It hadn't gone well for me. So I take my little book, my stack of AA literature, and go off down the hall to the first room. In the first room is Joe. Joe has been drinking and living outdoors for 40 years. Joe has at least 12, 14, 20 open wounds on his body. Joe's laying there in bed scratching. I say to Joe, standing far enough from the bed that my clothes won't touch it, "Hi, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Bob." Joe looks up, goes, "Hi, Bob." Well, Joe wants to shake hands. I don't want to shake hands with Joe, man. Joe's been digging all this stuff. You know? It's like, oh, no. God. But at that moment, of course, who do you hear? Your sponsor. I hear his voice booming in my head. Saying, "On any given occasion, at any given moment, you may be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous a man will ever see. Be the best example that you can." So I shake Joe's hand. While I talk to him, I'm holding my arm out here like this, you know. Joe won't touch my clothes, man. It's like, "I'm really, how are you doing, you know?" And I run down the hall to the bathroom and I wash my hands. Screw the soap for the general public. I go right past it to the surgical soap. You know, I'm like washing my hair. So by the time I finished my an hour and a half shift at that county hospital, I have washed my hands 26 times. My clothes feel like they're crawling on my body. I get in my car. I don't even want to touch the steering wheel. I think, oh, God, I got to touch it in the morning when I'm clean. What do I do? And then the people would lie to you. Now, my good buddy of mine, Jim, and I, we went to see this one guy, and he's laying there yellow with sunglasses on, right? And Jim says to him, "Hi, I'm Jim, this is Bob, we're from AA." And the guy looks at us and says, "Hey, cool, you guys dropped off, but I don't have a problem." I look at Jim looks at me, Jim looks at him and says, "Man, you're yellow!" We didn't have a lot of tact in those days either. Guy says, "I fell down and hurt my liver." I was at Jim looked at me, and we didn't know what to say. Yeah. So we left him a pamphlet and left. Yeah. It's like, okay, cool, you know, if that's your story, here, have this, and if you ever get out of here, come to a meeting. And in every prison meeting they gave me was in the middle of nowhere. The first one they gave me was Lompoc Penitentiary in California, which is a federal penitentiary. It's 150 miles past any lengths. It's, it's... The inside sponsor of the AA meeting was a practicing alcoholic Catholic priest who hated AA. It's a federal penitentiary. There's nobody in there doing less than 7 years bottom, you know. So, I mean, you can't say to the guy at his first meeting, he just can't get too enthused about AA because he's not going to be seeing the free world for somewhere between 7 and 15 years. It's like a really not a good panel, I didn't think. Anyway. I would go back to the meetings and I was hearing these people who were from another planet than me. I am so grateful for the opportunity to share at this hospital. You know, I can't get my clothes clean enough from sharing at the hospital. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to drive to this prison. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with me? Am I the only one that hates all of this stuff? You know? Am I the only one? But I wasn't going to say anything to anybody. Because there was no one else saying that they didn't like it. No one was saying, even though you hate it, do it anyway, your judgment may currently be impaired. You know? No one was saying none of that stuff. So I thought, how am I going to get along here? What the hell am I going to do? What's going to happen? And so I figured I had to get like the other people or I wasn't going to survive. So I figured, okay, what are the other people like? How do I get like the other people? So I started to watch the other people really carefully so I could figure out what you were doing. Because I had no idea. And I wanted to fit in. I did not want to not belong. Remember, this is a guy who was inadequate, insufficient, incomplete, and way down inside of me is this little spot I must keep hidden, keep it secret, so you cannot find out, so you won't make me go away, or you won't embarrass me, or you won't leave me. So I begin to watch carefully the recovering person, because I know I need to create a recovering personality. I got to somehow find somebody other than me. So I start to watch people, and finally I get it. It takes a little while, but I get it. I understand that to be an okay recovering person, all I have to do is be fine. As long as I'm always fine, I'm okay. Because I was noticing that everybody was always fine, no matter what. They had just lost their job, their car had been repossessed, and their dog had been stolen. And they would walk through the door of the meeting and say to Fred, "Hey, Fred, how are you?" "I'm fine, Fred, thanks." "Yourself?" "Good, thanks." And they would shake hands, and the guy would go sit down. And I'd think, what about all the stuff that happened to you? Not a word. So I got it. I'm fine. I'm okay. I was having a couple of small problems, though. Relationships were difficult. And anger seemed to be a small problem. And I was doing everything I could to anesthetize the anger. I was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, drinking 50 cups of coffee, and eating at least 6 pounds of sugar. It seemed to come out most often while driving. So I would be driving out a freeway to go to a meeting in Los Angeles, and someone would move in front of me without using their turn signal. Thirty seconds later, as I'm doing 100 miles an hour down the freeway, chasing them, screaming obscenities out the window, like a mad dog with foam coming out of my mouth. Eventually, if I was lucky, I didn't catch them. If I did, I was standing in the middle of our hood in an intersection trying to discuss their driving habits with them, being the best example of AA I knew how to be. Pull into the parking lot where the meeting was, wipe off the foam, straighten my car, brush back my hair from being blown in the wind while hanging out. You know. Walk into the meeting, Fred would be there at the door and say, "Hey, Bob, how are you?" I say, "Fine, Fred, man, how about you?" This little 100-mile-an-hour chase down the freeway seemed insignificant to my recovery. It had nothing to do with drinking. What the hell does it matter, you know, that I'm out trying to kill people?
I'm having employment problems.
My attitude, is it any wonder?
So finally I surrendered to God. I'm a couple of years sober, 3 years sober, I don't remember how long now.
I don't know how to get this. Is I don't know how to tell this. I'm trying to think of a way to tell this story short. Well, when I was about 3 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, working the most honest program I knew how to work, I accepted a job as a thermodynamics engineer for Williams Incorporation. Guy up here says, "What does that mean?" I unfortunately knew what it meant, but I couldn't spell it. I had 10th grade education. I had no idea what the hell in the world a thermodynamics engineer was, but I knew they used slide rules. So I went to the drugstore, Thrifty's, I think, and bought one. Took me about 4 or 5 hours to figure out how to multiply 2 times 2 on the slide rule, but I knew that I needed to see. I'm still back in Mrs. Clooney's class trying to work out 2 plus 2. So I become this thermodynamics engineer for Worthington Corporation, taking over all of Orange County. Small amount of stress. For someone who doesn't want to be found out. Little bit of tension. So much tension, if I had yet learned to cry, I would have been sitting in my car at stoplights weeping. But I hadn't gotten to that point yet. But you see, tension is familiar to me. I grew up in tension. I am uncomfortable in tension. If things are quiet and calm and peaceful, I can fix that. I can fix it in a heartbeat. I like tension. Even though it almost kills me, it's the only thing I'm comfortable with because it's the one emotional condition I know what to do with. I mean, I don't know about anybody else in this room, but anxiety has been my drug of choice since I got sober. You know. I can sit home alone in a chair by myself with absolutely no help from anyone and get nuts. Right off the planet. I create tension when I wake up. A lot of people know this story, but I used to talk about when I finally started to get it. Well, I'll come to it. I'll keep it in order. Well, I'm operating in this job okay. I'm pretty slick. You know, I know how to bring a lot of drugs in from Mexico and not get caught and make deals and do all that. So be it, thermodynamics engineers, and they're all a lot different than that, except they do have some more information than I possess. So I'm kind of booking around Orange County, putting a piece together here, a piece together there, doing this, doing that, and, you know, it's working out. And one of our major customers is a Signal Oil refinery in Huntington Beach. And they have these huge offshore towers. And they have 2 massive Worthington turbine pumps. And these 2 massive Worthington turbine pumps are what suck the oil into the land from the offshore tower so it can be refined. Well, I got a phone call. As an engineer, they give you give your home phone number to these people, these big accounts. I'm living in Laguna Beach. Huntington Beach is 30 miles, maybe, away from that. I'm home, 3 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. Bob, this is Fred Smith, Signal Oil. Night supervisor. I got to tell you, we got both our turbine pumps down. Neither one of them is working. We got major problems. We've got to stop the towers, blah, blah, blah. We've got to call into the guys and boys in Texas and L.A. and, you know, you and get your ass up here. I'm cool. I've got no problem. They've called Los Angeles. They called the Whiz Kids in Texas. Those guys are going to be on a jet in their pajamas for this account. You know, they ain't going to blink. I mean, some of the best brains Worthington Corporation has to offer are going to be in this oil field. I forget one thing. They all are hours away. I'm 30 minutes away. I get up, I get dressed, I get in my car, I drive to Signal Oil Refinery. Guess who's the first one there?
Here's all these men gathered under large spotlights, standing around with hard hats on in this oil field in the middle of the night looking very distressed, and I pull in my little red Plymouth Valiant. With air conditioning. No one else used to tell me I was the only guy in AA with a red economy car driving around with the windows up in the summer who actually had air conditioning. I pull in the oil field, I know I'm in trouble, and I open the door, and the supervisor says to me, "Hey, man, what's wrong? We got to fix this thing." And I'm tired. You know, I can only stand so much tension, and then I have to give up. And I looked at him and said, "I don't know how to tell you this, but not only do I not know what's wrong with those pumps, I don't even know how they work in the first place. You know, I have no idea." I was fired. The next morning, and I couldn't believe they fired me because I just brought them a big order from S&W Foods. I was stunned that they had the gall to fire me. By now, I'm about 4 years sober. There's a lot of stress in my life. You know, I understand about God. I understand about Eskimos. But I know that there's a few areas of my life that God won't help me with. Relationships, employment, and money. I decide I should take these three areas on myself. So by the time I'm approaching my fourth birthday in AA, I've been financially bankrupt through the courts. I haven't had relationships with women in so long my eyes are crossed. And, you know, they start to get it. If you get really desperate guys, they know. You can't even get them to go to coffee. You know, you come cruising across the meeting floor trying to look cool, saying, "Hey, you want to go have a little coffee, talk about God?" They ain't going. They're not going to budge. I'm sleeping on a couch of a baby of mine, a guy I don't even particularly like. I've borrowed money from every guy I've sponsored. I don't have a car because I lost it in the bankruptcy. I'm working in this car wash for $1.25 an hour. I started at $1.35. They had put me in soap, you know, washing the cars, but I got a rash from the detergent. It's a very manly thing to get, you know. So I had to be moved out of the detergents to the drive-off in. So I'm driving the cars off the line, wiping them down, accepting the quarter tip. This is cool. This is something I really like a lot, you know. And besides that, for those of you who have spent an excessive amount of time in institutions, you know you spend a lot of time sitting on concrete, which creates hemorrhoids. So now I'm bouncing enough off these hot car seats all day long, and my hemorrhoids are back. So basically, I rolled into my fourth birthday in AA, working in the car wash, sleeping on Jim's couch, just not even hardly knowing what a woman looked like anymore, not only an automobile, owing everyone I sponsored money, getting 12-step calls from central office, and I got to call a person up to see, A, are they sober enough to drive a car, B, do they have a car so they can pick me up so I can take them to the meeting. So I said to a friend of mine, "I ain't taking a cake." And he says, "Why not?" And I says, "What the hell am I going to tell the newcomer? Come in here, hang on, don't drink, and you can have this." You know? This can be your life. An Eskimo drove through the car. They gave me a cake at the Glendale Sanitarium Sunday morning meeting in the Nut House. That was effective. I enjoyed that. But I actually wanted to stay. 2 weeks later, I was up visiting this guy in Camarillo in the state mental hospital up there, and it's a nice spring day, and I'm laying on the lawn, and the trees are full, and the wind's blowing through the trees, and the birds are singing, and I'm laying there 4 years sober saying, "This is okay. I'd like to stay a little while. It'd be just fine to be here in the Nut House a little while, a lot less tension than I have currently in my life." An Eskimo guy through the car wash offers me a different job. Better job. I can still walk to it and make 50 cents an hour more. So I begin this job. Not happy, but I begin it. It's a die caster. I was working a die caster. I'm learning to meditate. Somebody taught me about meditation. I learned about self-realization fellowship, third eye meditation, where you focus on the third eye and leave your body. I like this. Leaving my body has been a favorite pastime of mine. So I'm now getting up 4 hours early in the morning to meditate. Oh, okay. Is that right? Oh, okay. That's not what you said when I got up here.
What am I missing here? Come up here and talk to me. Oh, I thought you said I had 2 minutes.
Oh. Communication problems between Chet and I, but we've just resolved them. And that's it. Thank you. And give you the rest of it later. Anyway, to make a long story short, about a half hour shorter than I thought. So where I was, I'm meditating 4 hours in the morning. I get up crack of dawn, 4 hours before I have to go to work to meditate. 4 hours in the lap of God. 4 hours of spiritual bliss. 4 hours of communion with my Father. Shower, get my clothes on, get in my car, pull out the driveway, turn right, someone cuts me off. I'm once again doing 100 miles an hour down a side street. Completely insane. So on one hand, and then finally I break my back as a die caster. This was a little gift from God. As a result of breaking my back, I became a television writer. 10th grade education, can't spell, and I failed English ever since they first mentioned the word. God has a great sense of humor. So now I'm a television writer, I'm a few years sober, I have surrendered myself to God, and my life is coming together. I'm writing television. I'm being paid obscene amounts of money for writing television. I have a small problem with relationships, however. I'm going through wives rather quickly. This little habit, unlike drugs and alcohol, is getting really expensive. You see, because being raised by an angry woman, I have a little catch back here, which is I can't make a woman mad because I'm afraid of angry women. So you get overtly angry, and I'll do anything to stop you from being overtly angry. You know, here's a credit card. Go shopping. Let me tell you, fellow men in the audience, that is not a good idea. No one can shop like an emotionally unhappy female, particularly if it's on the credit card belonging to the one that she's emotionally unhappy about. I have given American Express gold cards to women who could slam dunk Rodeo Drive in an afternoon, man. And did. But what the hell? I'm still a TV writer. I'm an AA speaker. People love me. I'm doing okay. I'm still doing 100 miles an hour down side streets chasing people in cars, but that's not important. I'm on about wife number four, but that's not important. Nobody cares about those things as long as I just keep being entertaining at the podium, and I'm fine when I come through the door to meet. Well, I stopped being fine, and I started talking about hearing voices sober. Lots of them. Unfriendly ones. Usually upon awakening. I used to talk, these voices were comprised as large vultures sitting on the head of my bed, looking down. I'd wake up and say to me, "Ah, good, glad you're awake. Been waiting to talk to you." First, I'd like you to know you didn't get enough sleep. I may have had 12 hours. It doesn't matter. The amount of time I didn't sleep, doesn't matter. Whatever it is not enough. Better not go to work today. But then again, if you don't go to work, they'll probably fire you. Better go to work. Well, that's not a good idea either, because as tired as you are, you go to work, you're going to get fired anyway. Well, God, you've lost your job. What are you going to do now? You haven't been very frugal with your money. You know, you don't have maybe enough for 6 weeks of that. If you're lucky, then you're going to be on the streets. And, oh, yeah, by the way, that bump just below your knee you thought was a bruise is bone cancer. How are you going to handle the bone cancer? You're going to go to meetings and talk about it? You're just going to be a chicken shit. Stay home and rot to death. Mornings have never been my favorite time of the day. I'm awake like 5 seconds. I'm broke, unemployed, living in the streets, and dying from cancer.
So I figure it's time to start talking at meetings about these voices, because they're wearing me out. They're absolutely wearing me out. So I start to talk about these voices at meetings, and people start to get unfriendly. But other people start to get like, yeah, no shit, you too? And there's a little group of us that begin to get together, sort of in clandestine, hidden places, and talk about the sober voices, you know? And then we became known in Southern California as the Lunatic Fringe of AA. So we thought, what the hell, as long as we're the Lunatic Fringe, let's put on meetings. So we did. Whenever any one of us was asked to speak anywhere, we took six of the rest of the others, and we would go let people see what our sobriety was like. But we were spending a great deal of time listening to people who weren't there, who didn't like us. So this went on until I was 17 years clean and sober. 17 years clean and sober, recognized AA speaker, known all over the world, living in a penthouse apartment on the beach at Santa Monica, working for a hit TV show, driving expensive cars, just divorcing one more highly gorgeous, expensive wife, got a gorgeous young girlfriend living in the penthouse with me, ready to roll into my 17th cake, and also I've been giving up things because things have been wiping me out sober. I've given up caffeine by this point. I've given up cigarettes by this point. I've given up sugar by this point. None of it is because I'm a good guy. None of it is because I'm some angelic personality. None of it is because I'm health conscious. None of it is because I got up and said, geez, I think I'll stop doing this. It's bad for me. I just happen to have a bad habit of using up my lifetime supply of stuff before I die. I gave up coffee when I got up one morning and my throat closed. It wouldn't go down, you know. When I'm waking up four times a night smoking cigarettes, crawling, wheezing across the bedroom, I thought perhaps if I want to have any kind of evolution in my recovery, I might want to stop doing this for a little while. Sugar I just gave up when I just got sick and tired of going into comas. You know, I'd have my breakfast. I'd go out, sit down in the kitchen, make my healthy granola breakfast cereal, put a little sugar on it, eat it, and go in and go to sleep for a half hour. You know. So I didn't give any of this stuff up out of some sense of nutritional consciousness. And in order to save my sanity from smoking, giving up smoking, I began to run because people said, you know, get some exercise going. I'm convinced today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if Dr. Bob and Bill were alive today, good nutrition, not smoking, and exercise would be an integral part of our recovery program. Absolutely. Because the benefits of it are too tremendous. Physical exercise will help you burn up the energy you use for anxiety. Is that cool? That's cool, man. I go out and run 15 miles. I got to tell you, I get home, sit in the chair, and my mind says, oh, what about that? Bill, you didn't pass. I don't care. There's something like that before that I had to go on all day. Oh, God. I can't deal with it. But I had one small problem. I got the penthouse, got the gorgeous woman, got the great job, got the money, got the fancy cars, got everything going on. I had one little teeny tiny problem. I wake up every day wanting to die. Drinking hasn't been an issue in my life for 10 years. By the time I'm 17 years sober, it hadn't crossed my mind. Either drinking or drugs. Never crossed my mind. What crossed my mind was dying. Not suicide, because I had to remove that as an option. I never thought of killing myself till I was sober. Ever. And it became like an option. I'd wake up in the morning and think, hey, screw it, you know what? If it stays this bad all day, I'll kill myself. Then a dear friend of mine who was as crazy as I was, we were both still sober, God bless him, said to me, we got to stop this. We talk about it together. We talk about driving down the freeway and taking out a wall 100 miles an hour, both of us. And what a tragedy it would be, and how they would miss us. And one day we said to each other, this can't be an option for us anymore. We must eliminate it as an option like we've eliminated alcohol, like we've eliminated drugs. It cannot be an option. We eliminate it. So then the only thought became dying. Became dying. I had one choice left. I'd done everything I knew how to do. I'd worked the steps, I don't know how many times. I'd written 32 inventories by this point in my life. I'd gone to meetings, sponsored people, carried panels, done absolutely everything he asked me today, and I wanted to die. I wanted to die. So I decided I'd go see a therapist. Now this is interesting. You know, I can't understand. People get so upset sometimes about what I say.
I would like to refer you to page, 132 or 133 of the big book, where they heartily suggest we avail ourselves of the psychologists and psychiatrists and many professionals out there to help us. This is the same book.
The AA police will wave in your face when you try to discuss your parakeet with pneumonia.
So my founders have said to me, son, go find what you need to find to take this path. That's what they said. And they were seekers, Bill especially. I go to see this woman therapist. I sit down in her office. This is the free get acquainted session. She says, tell me, start with your childhood, tell me a little bit about yourself. I says, when I was 15 years old, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. I discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. I drank and used for 11 years. Until I was 26 years of age, and 17 years ago, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober ever since. She said, wait a minute. I said, start with your childhood. You weren't born at 15. So I don't remember anything before 15. She got this very strange smile when I said that. By this point in my life, I'm a little cynical. So I knew what the smile meant. Smile meant the minute I left her office, she was going to call a Rolls Royce dealer and tell him she was going to take the one with the full leather interior, because she... Because the man who was going to pay for it just left her office. I didn't know what she was trying to say to me is one day, if I had the courage to stick it out with her, I was going to meet the man I really was instead of the man I thought I was. And she was smiling because she knew that if I had the courage to stick it out, she'd be there when that day came. And it would be a joyous moment for both of us. Well, I had the courage, I stuck it out, and she was right. One day in her office, I met the man I am instead of the man I thought I was all my life. I met the man I am instead of the lie I believed myself to be all my life. And it has been a joy. So I stand before you now. I'm 32 years sober, and I'll be 60. Good God, the end of this year. That's another thing. Sobriety isn't anything like what I thought it was, and neither 60. Believe me. I had to learn a lot. I had to learn about the results of what the hell was done to me when I was a kid and the impact it had on my life as an adult. You see, because I was doing everything I knew how to do in this program, but some of the stuff that was hanging on from when I was a kid was killing me. A, the angry woman beating me half to death was killing me in relationships with women. I couldn't have one. I couldn't stick it out. I had to get away. You get mad and I got to go. But I don't have the courage to tell you I got to go. So I got to drive you out. I have to drive you out. How do I drive you out? I use the same weapons my father used on my mother. I stop talking to you and stop having sexual relations with you. And lucky all the women I knew were in AA, so when they got completely crazy, they'd call their sponsor and say, I want to kill myself, and they'd say, he's not worth killing yourself over, and they'd leave. I'm currently married to the seventh Mrs. Earl. Six of them were in sobriety. I've also been married to the current Mrs. Earl for 7 years, which breaks all kinds of records. 18 months was the top going into this one. Probably more important than that I know how to have a relationship with a woman, that today I have a sense of esteem as to who I am, that my life is rich and full, and I take lots of chances and risks, and I'm a happy man. I'm also a father of a 7-year-old daughter. Now this, I want to tell you, has been an eye-opener. This has been the lesson that I never could learn. This has been a chance to make up for all the spankings that the first two daughters got that they didn't deserve. This has been an opportunity to make up for all the locking of these two little girls in a room that they didn't deserve, that this one never sees. I get to raise a child who has never been struck, never will be struck, and doesn't know what it would mean to be screamed at, yelled at, humiliated, put down, called names, or anything other than nurtured. I live with a little girl who only knows how it is to be powerful. We sometimes leave with babysitters and we come back and they say, well, she doesn't have any trouble asking for what she needs, does she? We say, no, she doesn't.
This little girl was about 4 years old. Her grandmother had died. Her grandmother had lived with us for about 2.5 years. And it's about changing the relationship. Don't really have time to go. We had my wife's... When I met my current wife's mother and father, I hated them. They felt even more strongly about me. We didn't like each other at all. It was absolutely god-awful. And finally, we got it resolved because Tina had to sit her parents down and say, enough. You want a daughter? This behavior must stop. End of comment. So they shaped up. I shaped up. We got together. And we had a sudden rash of deaths in our family. My mother, her dad died within a week of each other. Lost a 20-year-old stepdaughter to drug addiction in an alley. And we had Tina's mom we had to take care of, who was dying from emphysema. Her dad, when she was dying in the hospital, they were recluses, pretty much, these people, already been successful in what he did. There was only one male there in the hospital room to lay in the bed and hold him while he died. That was his son-in-law, me. I never got to hold my father. He died in the streets. When her mother died, her mother and I worked out a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff I couldn't work out with mine, because mine was unwilling and unable to work out any of it. And after my mother died, we got Dorothy. And Dorothy and I worked it out. When Dorothy died, in her bed with her was Tina and I, holding her, babying her, nursing her at home, midwifing her on to whatever it was waiting for. And our daughter had been through all these deaths, particularly her grandmother. The same weekend we lost her grandmother, we lost two dogs. It was a bad weekend in our house as far as a lot of emotional stress and grieving and crying. So our daughter has a real good knowledge of death. About 6 months after Grandma died, we were out somewhere, I don't remember where, we were with somebody else, I don't remember who, because what my daughter said to me shorted out all my circuits. One of the things I love about little girls, particularly that age, you know, 3-4 years old, is they know so much more than they have the words to express. So I used to really frustrate her, and I'd see her sometimes sitting there looking up inside her head for words. Like if she could just look in the right place, she'd find the right word. And as she was doing this, wherever we were, she did it for about 15 minutes. She kept looking back in the corners of her mind like she'd find some. And we do this little thing, she and I, you know what? And so finally she looked at me, she goes, you know what? I go, no, what? She says, I'm going to miss me when I'm died. Well, I got to tell you, I didn't have a reality on that one. I'm the guy who they told me in AA to go home and look in the mirror and tell myself I love me. I couldn't say the words. When I looked at me in the mirror, I wasn't going to miss me when I was gone. I thought one of the best things that could happen for me and the planet would be if I just disappeared. I had no sense of this kind of esteem, this kind of power this child had. Let's see. Okay. This little girl, when she was about 20 months old, we lived in a small town in northern Arizona. Very out in the country, rural. One of the things I learned about my daughter was, one of the ways I avoid emotional stress and recovery is I get into what's called task orientation.
I get busy, you know, and it gives me a reason to be here, to live. So the problem with task orientation is insignificant tasks take on unrealistic importance. Like getting to the supermarket by 4:30 becomes life and death, even though you have another 3 hours in which you could go to the market. And one thing I discovered about my daughter when she's old enough to walk is she wouldn't play the game with me. I'd look at my watch and say, I got to get to the market. I'd go get my kid and I'd take her by the hand and we'd head for the car. And the minute you try and move my daughter any faster than she wants to go, she'd just stop dead, plant both feet and go, walk self. Which simply put means you go your speed, I'll go mine, I'll see you, you know, when I get there. One night we're out walking up a road behind our house towards this town that we're in is surrounded by mesas, by these tabletop mountains. We're walking up towards this one mountain and the big moon is sitting out like a plate, man, just this full moon. And Alexander's walking in between Tina and I. Her nickname was Sasha then. She called herself Sasha. We called her Sasha. And she's walking herself. We're going very slow up the road towards the moon. And suddenly she goes, she goes, she starts going like this. She's looking at the moon. She goes, oh, oh, she says, oh, Sasha's flying. She goes, oh, Sasha's flying in the air. Oh, Sasha's flying in the air. She says, Sasha's holding the moon.
My wife is 20 years sober and I look at each other with tears streaming down our faces. And we had the same thought at the same time. We said, my God, you know what? This child's spirit might be free enough that she just flew to the moon. Because no one has stepped on this child's spirit. My wife is a product of two alcoholics. I'm the product of one. Our spirit had been pretty well destroyed by the time we were growing up. And we could just only sob and cry tears of joy that this little person, where do they get this stuff, is flying to the moon, you see. Because no one has smacked her down. No one has humiliated her, embarrassed her, or had any humor at her expense. She's a very proud, very beautiful little girl. We had wanted to bring her, but then we couldn't bring her, and then people normally take care of her, gone. Anyway, she's in a thing at church tomorrow. I believe that if we're true to ourselves here, one day we all can walk self, and one day we all can fly to the moon, that we can get through the stuff we need to get through. But what I'm here to tell you tonight, and this is, if, and everything I say is my opinion, so don't get nuts, okay? You've got to be really, if you're home tonight pacing at 3 o'clock in the morning and completely nuts over what I said, I want to tell you, I have a habit of changing my mind on the way to the airport. You know, so, while something I've said may have you give you acid indigestion, I'll be going to the airport saying, I don't know if that's right or not. I wonder if that's really true. That may not be true. But I do know this, I want to give you the permission, at least in my opinion, to take the path you need to take, to find the tools you need to take to move your recovery forward. Recovery for me is about the quality of my life while sober. The quality of my life while sober. And I take the steps and I take the risks and I take the chances and I take the path to try and be the best possible human being I can be, to get to my feelings, clean out the old ones and make room for the new ones. We are very clever, very powerful people. Maybe you don't know that, but that, in fact, is the truth. I am so grateful for AA because it's the table, the foundation on which I began this building process. But today my life is filled with many tools. AA, ACA, CODA, therapy, church, men's groups that I belong to, men's work that I do with other men. We've got a lot of work to do together, guys. We've got a lot of tears to cry. We've got a lot of anger to get out and a lot of tears to cry. In my opinion, in order to evolve and improve the quality of life. I've had great fun being here. I wish I could tell you more about today. I'm sorry. I didn't. I thought I had more time, or I would have canned some of the early stuff and devoted a little more time to now. But God bless you, and I wish you well on your path, and have a great dance. Good night.